From Washington, this is VOA News. There will be a new trial in Egypt for three jailed Al Jazeera journalists. A suicide bomber strikes a Nigerian church. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. An Egyptian court has ruled that three jailed Al Jazeera journalists will get a new trial. The Court of Cassation in Cairo announced the decision after a brief hearing today, but did not set a date for the retrial. Australian Peter Grest, Canadian-Egyptian Mohamed Fahmy, and Egyptian Baher Mohamed were not in court and will remain in jail. Osama Saeed is a spokesman for the Al Jazeera network.
It seems like there's going to be a retrial. Our call is to the Egyptian government, to the Egyptian authorities, to make that a fast process now. This shouldn't take months and months and months to come to a conclusion. Everybody around the world can see that these guys should be released, and they should have been released a long time ago.
In July, a court convicted the three of supporting the banned Muslim Brotherhood. The World Health Organization has put the number of Ebola deaths in West Africa at just over 7,900. The WHO says more than 20,000 cases of the disease have been reported since the outbreak began in 2013. Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone have been the hardest hit countries. Meanwhile, Reuters reports that Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma is asking his country to begin a week of prayer and fasting for an end to the Ebola epidemic. He made that plea today during his New Year's address. AFP quotes a Red Cross aid worker as saying a suicide bomber today blew himself up outside a church in northeastern Nigeria. The explosion went off outside the ECWA church in Gombe when the bomber was prevented from entering the building compound. This is VOA News. Quoting a military source, the AFP News Service reports that four Gambian military officers have taken refuge in Guinea-Bissau. The four are suspected of taking part in a failed military coup against President Yahya Jammeh. A group of men led by an army deserter attacked the presidential palace in Banjul on Tuesday, but were repelled by forces loyal to Mr. Jammeh. The president, meanwhile, is blaming unidentified foreign dissidents and terrorists for the attack. Afghan officials are investigating whether soldiers fired a rocket at a wedding party, killing at least 26 people late Wednesday. Dozens more were wounded in the unexplained attack in southern Helmand province, which police believe was launched from a nearby army checkpoint. The United Nations says most of the victims were women and children. Pakistan is accusing India of ambushing and killing two border security guards it says were invited to a routine meeting in Kashmir by their Indian counterparts. Pakistan summoned a senior Indian diplomat to lodge a strong protest. India has a different version of events, saying Pakistani forces opened fire, allowing Islamist militants to target more than a dozen Indian outposts. Pakistan denies the charges. This from Reuters. Ukrainian rebels rang in the new year today by staging attacks on government forces. The Ukrainian military says three of its soldiers were wounded in the attacks. The mortar and small arms attacks happened in the east of the country. Meanwhile, President Petro Poroshenko told the nation the new year will not be easy. He said Ukraine has endured its worst year since the end of World War II. He said the government this year will enact deep-seated reforms, opening the road to membership in the European Union. Lebanese news reports say former Prime Minister Omar Karami has died. He was 80 years old. His death comes after an undisclosed illness. Israel's ruling Likud party has chosen its leader. The choice is no surprise. AFP reports Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been reelected party leader and will lead Likud into the upcoming election. Mr. Netanyahu received up to 80% of the votes in a party election Wednesday. Reuters reports that at least 39 people have been killed in floods and landslides in Sri Lanka. The Sri Lankan Disaster Management Center said today more than a million people have fled their homes in the past 2 weeks as the result of rain. This from AFP. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says 76,000 people were killed in the Syrian civil war in 2014. It says this past year has been the deadliest in the nearly four-year-long war. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehis Wuhib in Washington, wishing you all a happy new year. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
One of the longest-standing rebel groups in the Democratic Republic of Congo is facing a Friday deadline to disarm or face military action from UN peacekeepers and Congolese armed forces. Some members of the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, or FDLR, have reportedly surrendered, but the international community says it is not enough.
That's VOA's Gabe Jaslow reporting. Details coming up also in the news. The Nigerian military says it is recapturing more towns in the northeast that had been taken over by the Boko Haram militant group. And because of Ebola, there are growing calls for the International Monetary Fund to eliminate some of the debt for Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the Nigerian military says it is recapturing more towns in the northeast that had been taken over by the Boko Haram militant group. It says its offensive will continue until all such towns are retaken. The military also pledged that there will be adequate security for next month's general election. The statements follow more reports of suicide bombers attacking in northeast Nigeria. Two bomb blasts were reported yesterday near a military checkpoint along the Patisukum-Gombe Road in Yombe State. At least 13 people were reported killed. One of the longest-standing rebel groups in the Democratic Republic of Congo is facing a deadline tomorrow to disarm or face military action from UN peacekeepers and Congolese armed forces. VOA's Gabe Jaslow reports some members of the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, FDLR, have reportedly surrendered, but the international community says it is not enough.
In July, regional heads of state gave the FDLR 6 months to fully disarm or face military action. That deadline comes on Friday, January 2nd. The group, which was formed by Hutu fighters responsible for the 1994 Rwandan genocide, has been accused of committing atrocities in the eastern Congo. The Congolese military and the United Nations peacekeeping force, MONUSCO, have promised to take action against the FDLR if the rebels fail to lay down their weapons. In a call with reporters Tuesday, U.S. Special Envoy to the Great Lakes region, Russell Feingold, said the United States also supports the use of military force against the group.
As the group has clearly demonstrated over the past 6 months, that a purely voluntary surrender process will not work to end the threat from this illegitimate armed group. Instead, military action must be undertaken to pressure the FDLR to lay down its arms.
Last Sunday, about 150 FDLR soldiers reportedly surrendered to Congolese authorities in North Kivu province. Feingold says the latest estimates suggest there are still about 1,400 fighters at large. Rwanda, which considers the FDLR one of its greatest threats, disapproved of the decision to give the group more time to disarm. Rwandan officials have called into question whether the Congolese army and UN forces are really ready to eliminate the rebels. Special Envoy Feingold dismissed these doubts.
I have received repeated assurances from the key stakeholder countries that they are committed to ending the threat of the FDLR and are prepared to follow up that commitment with action.
In 2013, the same collaboration of UN and Congolese forces successfully defeated the M23 rebel group, which had seized control of territory in eastern Congo. UN experts and rights groups have accused Rwanda of supporting the M23 in part to shore up its defenses against the FDLR. Gabe Jaslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
The United Nations new Ebola mission chief heads to West Africa next week. It will be Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed's first visit there since his appointment in December. His visit begins in Ghana on Monday and later include Guinea, Mali, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. He'll be joined by the UN Special Envoy on Ebola, David Nabarro. The World Health Organization says the death toll from Ebola in West Africa is now more than 7,900. The total number of cases is now 20,206. Meanwhile, Liberia last night lifted its curfew to allow people to attend New Year's Eve religious services. The curfew had been in effect since August due to the Ebola outbreak. Liberia has been the hardest hit country, but health officials say the number of new infections has slowed. The curfew goes back into effect tonight. Also, there are growing calls for the International Monetary Fund to eliminate some of the debt for Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The Ebola epidemic has hurt their economies. U.S. Treasury Secretary Jacob Lew says the move would help restart their economies. He says the IMF should wipe out about one-fifth of the nearly $500 million the three countries owe the lending agency. And the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders says, while progress has been made against Ebola, it warns local populations appear to be getting less vigilant about safety measures and messages. The head of a prominent HIV/AIDS advocacy organization says 2015 will be a year of great opportunities and great challenges. The epidemic is nearly 35 years old and more than 30 million people are estimated to be living with HIV. VOA's Jody Kapowa reports.
Mitchell Warren says one challenge of the new year will be to translate recent scientific advances into practice. Warren is executive director of AVAC, which he says aims to accelerate the ethical development and global delivery of HIV prevention tools as part of a comprehensive response.
This is a year that will define the AIDS response. We're now over 34 years into the epidemic, and it is truly a point at which we will know if we are on the right track to ever ending this epidemic, or if we continue to muddle through year by year, hoping we do the right things but not knowing for sure.
He says early in 2015, results should be announced regarding a promising HIV prevention option, an effective microbicide.
As you may recall, back in 2010, we had the initial proof of concept of the CAPRISA trial that showed that tenofovir gel provided some partial protection for women in South Africa.
Tenofovir is an antiretroviral, widely used to subdue the virus within the body, but it's also been shown to be effective in preventing infections. Since 2010, a study has been underway to confirm and expand on the CAPRISA findings. It's called FACS-001 and is also taking place in South Africa. The study is funded by the U.S. and South African governments and the Gates Foundation. Warren says FACS-001 could confirm whether tenofovir gel used before and after sex can prevent HIV infection.
The results are expected in the first quarter of the year. If that's a positive result and if it confirms the CAPRISA finding, we would then be looking at how do you take that product forward outside of clinical trial into practice. So a very exciting first quarter, I think, just because of that trial result.
At the end of 2015 and in early 2016, the results of two other microbicide studies are expected to be released. One will look at the effectiveness of a vaginal ring filled with an antiretroviral drug. Also in South Africa, an AIDS vaccine trial gets underway this year. It's a follow-up to the 2009 Thailand vaccine trial that showed protection against HIV was possible. The results from the South Africa trial and related studies, however, will not be available for several years. Meanwhile, greater use of antiretrovirals as a preventive measure is expected. It's called PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis. But the AVAC executive director says the predominant use will remain as treatment for those infected.
2014 ended with the calls by the United Nations AIDS program, UNAIDS, to really set a new target about treatment. The UNAIDS new target is this 90-90-90, trying to make sure that 90% of people who are infected know their status, that 90% of them get onto treatment, and that 90% of those on treatment are what we call virologically suppressed. And if they're virologically suppressed, it means they're very unlikely to transmit HIV.
He says an ambitious but feasible goal would be to have 15 million people on HIV treatment by the end of 2015.
That would be a terrific step in the right direction. But of course, there are over 30 million people infected with HIV. So we have a very long way to go to really see treatment scale up to the degree that we need it to. But it is on the right trajectory. Drug pricing is coming down because you have much higher volumes.
However, he says, there are antiretroviral supply problems at some clinics in developing countries.
For all of the excitement around prevention, around treatment, it really becomes a resource question because this success in the AIDS response does not come cheap, and it certainly does not come free. And the question really becomes, are we as a global community going to continue to scale up our investments in the things that we know can work? Because all the talk of ending the epidemic is predicated on good science and on real resources, and we're beginning to see those resources eroding.
Warren does not foresee an end to the HIV/AIDS epidemic for at least 10 years. One of the obstacles is ongoing stigma and discrimination. He says unless that problem is solved, no vaccine or antiretroviral will be effective in the long term. He adds that there is no medical response that can address people's perceptions of others. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Seventeen past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Three Al Jazeera journalists are expected to get a new trial in Egypt after an appeals court struck down their guilty verdict. They had been sentenced to 7 to 10 years in prison. Family members and supporters, however, expressed a disappointment that the journalists were not released immediately pending a retrial. Edward Uranian has more from Cairo.
The appellate court decision to throw out the verdict in the case of three Al Jazeera TV journalists drew applause and criticism after the judicial panel ruled the men must be retried. But the presiding judge said he did not have the authority to release the men on bail. Reporters were not allowed to attend the court session, and the ruling was handed down quickly. Family members of the three journalists, as well as their attorneys, expressed anger that the men were not acquitted or released on bail. Marwa Omara, the fiancé of Al Jazeera producer Mohamed Fahmy, was saddened by the verdict and told journalists she hoped Egyptian authorities would use their power to find a quick resolution to the journalist's detention.
I can't even imagine that he will stay for a year in prison. His lawyer, Amal Clooney, just applied to the Egyptian presidency and the Egyptian prosecutor for Mohammed to be deported to Canada and be treated as a Canadian citizen and to continue the trial there.
Egyptian authorities accused the men of operating illegally without press credentials. The government closed Jazeera TV's offices in August 2013, accusing it of supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. The group had been holding street demonstrations, some of which turned violent, to protest the ouster of former President Mohamed Morsi that July. Al Jazeera's acting general manager, Mustafa Suwag, applauded the appeals court decision, but said the journalists should be released. He says that he welcomes the decision by the appellate court to accept the appeal presented by the imprisoned Jazeera journalists, but would also have liked that they be released since they are being held unjustly. The decision against him, he says, as well as their arrest and trial, were politically motivated, and their presence in an Egyptian jail remains political. Veteran Egyptian editor and publisher Hisham Qassem tells VOA that despite the background of a regional spat between Egypt and Qatar over the latter's support for the Muslim Brotherhood group, he thinks the condemnation of the journalists was unfair.
The initial verdict is a sham. It's full of procedural mistakes, and the Cassation Court has been known to shoot down rulings like these. So regardless of what is going on between Egypt and Qatar right now, we were going to get the same ruling today. However, as there's been a mistrial, I don't see why they should remain under arrest pending trial. And this is probably where the prosecutor general can interfere and have them released until the new date for trial.
There has been some speculation in the Egyptian media that President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi might pardon the three men, but Qassem believes that unlikely, if only for procedural reasons, until a final verdict in a retrial is reached. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A political analyst says civil strife is likely to continue in many African countries unless their leaders stop putting personal interests ahead of national interests. Ernest Tindua is the General Secretary for the Political Science Association of Malawi and Chancellor College of the University of Malawi. He says countries such as Egypt, Nigeria, and Sudan have failed to end the civil strife because their leaders have failed to meet the needs of their citizens. Tindua spoke to reporter Lamek Masina about the political developments that dominated Africa in 2014.
There have been some positive and negative developments. I think positive developments, we have had some elections, most of which have been declared as free and fair and credible. We had elections in South Africa, we had elections in Malawi, and a few other countries.
We understand that in these elections, there were also some problems noted.
Yeah, of course, there have been some problems here and there, particularly for elections in Malawi. But at least we are making headway in terms of attending towards free and fair elections.
What are the negatives that dominated the political scene in Africa in 2014?
The negative sides are obviously the civil strife. Talking of countries like Southern Sudan, there have been some civil war in Southern Sudan. One would have hoped that being a new country, perhaps it would be on its path to democratic maturity. But it looks like Southern Sudan is having problems in terms of strengthening its democratic institutions. You have the presidency being challenged. You have institutions that are key for promotion of democracy, such as security, courts, and the like, being undermined. Then you have problems, obviously, in Kenya. You are seeing frequent attacks by some fundamentalists, which is, again, is unfortunate. Then you have also a problem in Nigeria, particularly northeast Nigeria, where you have Boko Haram, indeed, terrorizing the whole part of northeast Nigeria, which is also unfortunate. Here and there, you see skirmishes in DRC, particularly East Congo. You still have problems there, and you have also problems in Somalia. In the Arab world, you still have problems in countries like Libya and, to some extent, in Egypt, where people felt perhaps democracy would take root. It has not.
So what do you think have been the major causes of these challenges or problems, or where do you think the African politicians have failed in 2014?
Politicians in Africa seem not to be very much concerned about saving the country. I think they put their personal interest ahead of national interest. That's why you have problems in countries like Nigeria, Egypt, Libya. So one would think that a Nigerian government committed to addressing social issues would surely deal with the insurgency by Boko Haram in northern east Nigeria. But you see a government that is seem not to be ill-equipped, and they did not prepare to deal with the problem. Or it's because political survival is put ahead of national interest. The same would go to countries like Southern Sudan. Iran, where a very young country, where you'd think that people who share a common heritage, common history, common culture, would lead a work together to build a prosperous southern Sudan. But that's not the case, ideally because personal interests override national interests. And that's where the problem is.
What do you think is needed to be done to correct such a situation?
So you need a kind of politicians, a certain breed that is committed to promoting national interests. Unfortunately, those kinds of politicians are not in large supply in Africa. There are very, very few people who would really come to the throne and indeed are work to address national issues. Most of them are geared towards self-aggrandizement. That's why you have some people use extra democratic means in order to access power and indeed have access to public resources for their only benefit. That's a challenge in Africa.
Now, what's your focus for 2015 as far as political development are concerned in Africa?
I think political development in Africa will remain a challenge because in most countries, democratic institutions remain weak. You have the executive that is disproportionately more influential, more powerful than the other arms of government, that is legislature and judiciary. That is the case in most countries, including, you know, Malawi, where I come from. So I don't see major significant improvements in terms of political development in Africa. There'll be improvement, but they'll be very marginal.
So what do you think can be done to improve the political developments in Africa?
My personal view is that the civility, meaning the civilians, the citizens themselves, should take it upon itself that they need to take their politicians to account for whatever they do. So in this case, what we need is a civil society taking charge of the process of following it up on the budget processes. By the budget processes, I'm talking about right from budget formulation, approval and implementation. In as long as citizens are not being mobilized to put pressure on politicians, politicians will always have their way, and their way is simply to promote their personal interest.
That was Ernest Tindiwa, the General Secretary for the Political Science Association of Malawi. He spoke to VOA's reporter Lamek Masina. Pope Francis says people of all religions and cultures should unite to end modern-day slavery and human trafficking. The pontiff made the call on New Year's Day, which is also the Roman Catholic Church's World Day of Peace. This year's theme is no longer slaves, but brothers and sisters. Modern-day slavery includes being forced to work under threat, being bought and sold as property, having restrictions placed on freedom of movement, and child and forced marriages. Some estimates say as many as 36 million people are victims of modern-day slavery. Pope Francis says everyone has the God-given right to be free. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
On Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover.
You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the Internet at www.voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The Nigerian military says it is recapturing more towns in the northeast that had been taken over by the Boko Haram militant group. One of the longest-standing rebel groups in the DRC is facing a Friday deadline to disarm or face military action. And because of Ebola, there are growing calls for the International Monetary Fund to eliminate some of the debt for Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Coming up, music from Uganda. And in our feature segment, a Kenyan jump rope team from the slums of Kibera hoping to become world champions. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Sporty New Year to you,
I like Sonny. I like that, yes. Happy Sporty New Year to you and to all our VOA listeners.
I understand you're kicking off the new year with Nations Cup football news.
Yes, we're now 16 days away to the kickoff of the Africa Cup of Nations football tournament in Equatorial Guinea. And the 16 teams continue to tinker with and finalize their rosters. The Eagles of Mali, who have finished third at the past two Nations Cup competitions, could be without top Bordeaux striker Cheick Diabaté because of a knee injury. Diabaté was named to Mali's 23-man Nations Cup team last week. But reports from France say the 26-year-old Diabaté might be undergoing knee surgery soon, and he'd be sidelined up to 3 months. Diabaté was the joint top scorer at the 2012 Nations Cup with 3 goals. Mali has been grouped with Guinea, Cameroon, and Ivory Coast at the 2015 Nations Cup. Mali will meet Cameroon January 20th in its opening match in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea. The Elephants of Ivory Coast, meanwhile, will go against Guinea January 20th in Malabo in the opening Nations Cup match for both teams. This looks like it'll be the last international tournament where we see the Touré brothers, Yaya and Kolo, step on the pitch together for the Elephants. 33-year-old Kolo Touré, a defender for Liverpool in the English Premier League, says he plans to retire from international duty after the Nations Cup. His younger brother, 31-year-old Yaya Touré, is a midfielder for Premiership club Manchester City. And this reminder for our VOA football fans, in exactly 1 week on January 8th, Yaya Touré will be bidding for an unprecedented fourth consecutive African Footballer of the Year trophy at the CAF Awards Gala in Lagos, Nigeria. Well, if you tuned into Tuesday's Sunny Side of Sports, you heard our African football guru David Legg give us some of his highlights from 2014. This evening, David has some of his lowlights, and he begins with the murder of a South African goalkeeper.
I think for me, Sonny, the saddest moment of the year was when I saw the tweets that confirmed that Senzo Maiyiwa, the South African goalkeeper, had been murdered. He had gone to visit his girlfriend at her mother's home in a township just south of Johannesburg. And to this day, Sonny, a lot of confusion as to exactly what happened. Disputes over whether the original story about people who barged into the house, shot Mayu, were dead, are actually true. There have since been other reports that, in fact, somebody who was in the house at the time when Mayu was there actually shot him. So it's very much an unsolved case. And the police put up a lot of money, several hundred thousand rands, for information leading to the arrest of the killer or killers. That hasn't yielded any results either. But what sadly has happened, Sonny, and we know very factually, is that Senzo Miyiwa is no longer with us. He has been outstanding for Orlando Pirates and almost single-handedly helped South Africa qualify for the Nations Cup finals for the first time since 2008 in four matches against Congo Brazzaville twice, Sudan once, and Nigeria once. He kept four clean sheets. But sadly, at the end of October, murdered and fondly remembered, I believe, not only by South African football followers, but those throughout the continent. Equally sad, Sonny, was the Ebola epidemic, which has hit particularly hard the countries of Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, but has had a knock-on effect on other parts of Africa, none more so than Morocco. Morocco, in fact, were due to host the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, but they wanted it postponed from January. CAF said no. They said the show must go on, and here I do support the African governing football body. They said that if you have a postponement once, it could happen again. Sponsors would lose their respect for CAF, and so on and so forth. Anyway, Morocco were forced to withdraw. And then in stepped at the very last minute the tiny nation of Equatorial Guinea, which is part island and part mainland in the heart of Central Africa. They, in fact, Sonny, had exactly 62 days to prepare for a tournament, which begins on January the 17th. And the encouraging news from Equatorial Guinea is that by January the 7th, Equatorial Guinean officials say everything will be in order for the finals. They've moved very quickly. Among the other things they've done is literally fly in two pitches from Europe. The quality of the turf at Mangomo and Ebeyin, that's the two smaller venues, was apparently not up to international standards. So they dug it up and then they flew in grass from Europe. So let's keep our fingers crossed that it all works out fine. Other lowlights, Sonny, if you're a Nigerian football follower, you would have been, I believe, should be anyway, reasonably satisfied with the World Cup performance, but you will definitely not be satisfied with the Nations Cup performance. Nigeria, the defending champions, failing to qualify for the finals in Equatorial Guinea, finishing only third behind South Africa and Congo Brazzaville. And I think the lesson for Nigerian football from 2014 is if you do not get your act together off the pitch, you're going to struggle on the pitch. There was no end of power struggles. One didn't know from one day to the next whether Nigeria was actually part of FIFA or suspended. Stephen Keshi was in and out as the national coach, like a yo-yo. And I think it was very naive of Nigerian officials to believe that this would not affect the national team. They really struggled from the start. They lost their first match at home to Congo Brazzaville, their first ever home defeat in a Nations Cup qualifier. They then drew away with South Africa and then lost in Sudan. So the red lights were flashing. But Keshi did wave his magic wand. He got a home win over Sudan. He got a away win over Congo Brazzaville. And then right at the death, they had to beat South Africa in their final match, but were unable to do so. They trailed 2-0, eventually forced a 2-2 draw, which gave them the very hollow consolation of never having lost a competitive match to their arch rivals, South Africa. Just to make matters worse for Nigerian football followers, and there are so many millions of them, was the poor performance of the clubs in the CAF competitions. Kano Pillars going out in the preliminary round, Enyimba going out in the first round, Wari Wolves going out in the build-up to the group phase of the Confederation Cup, and by Bayelsa United losing in a playoff to Seaway Sport. So all in all, Sonny, on and off the field, not a really great year for Nigeria. And another country that had a really bad 2014, at national team level at least, was Egypt. Now, Egypt, of course, won the Nations Cup a record three consecutive times, 2006, 2008, and 2010. And it was beginning to look like a dynasty, a monopoly had been established here, and that Egypt were going to go on and rule African football for years to come. But it all came thundering down. They failed to qualify in 2012 or 2013. And now again, disappointment as they finished third behind Tunisia and Senegal, and they will not be in Equatorial Guinea either. So two very notable omissions from the 16-nation Africa Cup competition in the shape of the Super Eagles of Nigeria and the Pharaohs of Egypt.
Thanks, David. And Happy New Year. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Happy New Year!
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, this one,
every show brings you the best music from across the continent, old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
Thanks, Heather, and I'll be tuning in this weekend to Music Time in Africa. Mark Ouma joins us now with a package of African athletic news, and Mark begins with a victory by an Ethiopian runner in a New Year's Eve race in Italy.
Mukhtar Idris pipped Iman Marga in a sprint for the finish line to hand Ethiopia a 1-2 triumph in the men's 10-kilometer race at the end of the year San Silvestre 10-kilometer road race in Bolzano, Italy on Wednesday. They were both credited with an identical time of 29 minutes and 8 seconds, while New Zealand's Zane Robertson edged Kenyan Olympic 5,000-meter bronze medalist Thomas Longisiwa to claim the bronze medal. Meanwhile, Janet Kisa outpaced Paris' Jepchirchir in a Kenyan 1-2 win in the women's 5 kilometers. Kisa clocked 15 minutes and 50 seconds, 1 second faster than Jepchirchir, while Ethiopian Alemitu Hawi was placed third. Meanwhile, two-time Ethiopian Standard Chartered Dubai Marathon champion Asefelek Mergia has confirmed she will be aiming for her third win at the event in Dubai, United Arab Emirates on the 23rd of January. Winner of the race in 2011 and 2012, Mergia took time off to have a baby last year and aims to return to her winning ways later this month. In Kenya, the National Olympic Committee of Kenya head Kipchoge Keino says they will push for tough legislation to criminalize those involved in doping in sports. Kipchoge told the Nairobi media on Wednesday that the recent spate of dope test failures by several Kenyan long-distance runners has dented the country's reputation in athletics. He says those who are innocent of cheating should be protected, while offenders and the agents implicated in dope offenses should face the full might of the law. The government is in the process of setting up the new anti-doping agency of Kenya.
Thanks, Mark, and Happy New Year. That's our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Wishing you all a Happy New Year. Back to you, Hayes. Wooey.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, a Kenyan jump rope team from the slums of Kibera hoping to become world champions. And next, South Africa's businesses and households being crippled by power shortages. But first, some music from Uganda. Here is George Okudi and Josephine Atanga with Celebrate Africa.
Celebrate, 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 celebrate Africa. We sing this song. land of Africa. A beautiful people, united in a rainbow color. A people with a culture that never grows weary.
So let's be united as the children of Mother Africa.
The voice of the children echoing the hills, proclaiming there's a future in the land. So long a taste of the mother will begin. As children will be singing songs of joy in the valley.
Remember Africa, you are the beauty of Mother Nature.
George Okudi and Josephine Tanga with Celebrate Africa. A Kenyan jump rope team is hoping to become world champs after winning many competitions. The team members are all from the Nairobi slum of Kibera and are between the ages of 8 and 18. Lenny Ruvaga profiles the team and how jumping rope has helped them avoid negative peer pressure.
18-year-old Wycliffe Otieno prepares for his daily jump rope practice. The tools of his trade, a pair of shoes, a water bottle, and a second change of clothes. Otieno took up the sport 4 years ago and is part of the Carolina for Kibera jump rope initiative dubbed the CFK Sprinters. He has been practicing 4 times a week for up to 2 hours a day, and that hard work has paid off. In June, the CFK Sprinters represented Kenya and came in third out of 16 countries at the 2014 World Jump Rope Competition that was held in the U.S. state of Florida. But Otieno says he nearly did not pursue the sport for the wrong reasons.
After class, I'd find people practicing jump rope and my interest was piqued. But I thought it was a game for only girls. Only girls jump rope. Later, I saw boys practicing, but they weren't that keen since they too viewed jump rope as a sport for girls. I saw an opportunity to learn and improve my skills, and I decided to take it up seriously.
Carolina for Kibera, an international NGO, started the Jump Rope Initiative in 2010, gearing it towards children aged between 8 and 18 years of age living in Nairobi's informal settlement. So far, the CFK Sprinters has around 100 children enrolled in the program. They provide training, a jump rope, and a pair of shoes, which cost about $10, too much for most Kibera families to afford. 15-year-old Christine Ondeko, among the first to join the jump rope club 4 years ago, says she wishes there were more support for her sport, which many people just view as a playground activity.
Parents oppose because they don't think it's girl stuff. It's like they think it's time wasting. It can't help in anything. On the ground, we face challenges like here are rocks. Some get injured because they don't have shoes. Lack of shorts for girls, mostly and tights, and shirts for training, because you can't train with the same clothes you come with and go with them home.
Since 2001, Carolina Fukibera has been helping the local young people through various initiatives, including the Tabitha Medical Clinic, which treats the CFK sprinters at no cost when they get training injuries. David Okoth, one of the three coaches, takes pride in not only conditioning the CFK sprinters, but giving them a sense of self-worth through mentorship.
Generally, jump rope brings the youth around Kibera together. For those who cannot take part in any other sports like football, running, they can take part in jump rope. And despite them taking part in jump rope, we still impact them with the life skills information, such as HIV, teenage pregnancies, and the bad companies.
This dedication has seen the team win three international championships while helping young people feel safe and valued. As they hone their skills, the CFK sprinters look forward to next year's World Youth Championships in France. And maybe, just maybe, this time they'll take first place. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
South Africa's businesses and households have been crippled by power shortages. The country's only power utility, Eskom, has intensified controlled power to prevent a total collapse of the grid. As Gillian Parker reports from Johannesburg, the state utility has intermittently reduced power supply by as much as 4,000 megawatts.
Eskom CEO Thidiso Matona said South Africans should brace themselves for another 18 months of power supply troubles. 3 weeks of tight electricity supply culminated in rolling blackouts during the weekend, which Eskom says were attributed to the utility neglecting to order enough diesel to fire emergency gas turbines used to generate power when the system is stressed. Businesses and residents are beginning to count the cost of the worst case of controlled power cuts they have seen. Johannesburg coffee shop manager Corinne Jones says the business has been engulfed in darkness every night for the past 4 days, forcing staff cuts as customers go elsewhere.
It's affecting jobs, it's affecting business, it's affecting customer services. And we bake at night, so it affects our baking. My bakers can't be baking between 6 and 10, then what's the point of having the staff between 6 and 10? What's the point of keeping those bakers?
Eskom, which supplies more than 95% of the country's power, has intensified managed blackouts as delays in new plant openings stretch its aging 27 plants to breaking point. South Africa's power infrastructure has suffered from mismanagement and underinvestment. Producing electricity below cost is financially unsustainable, Eskom says, and partly to blame for the outages. Matona told journalists, "We have run our plants very hard, and not having done proper maintenance in the past has now come to haunt us." Some analysts estimate the blackouts have reduced economic growth significantly, costing the economy $44.4 billion since 2008. The retail, automotive and manufacturing sectors in South Africa have been hardest hit, say economists. The Steel and Engineering Industries Federation of Southern Africa said that power outages were totally unacceptable. The Federation estimates the crisis has cost the metals and engineering sectors $520 million. The Federation says poor power supply is likely to damage South Africa's reputation as an investment destination, causing untold harm to the economy. The energy-intensive user group of Southern Africa represents the 32 biggest electricity consumers who use 41% of South Africa's electricity. Group spokesman Sean Neal says the power crisis is hurting investment.
The lack of capacity means that any expansion plans are being put on hold, and the impact that these blackouts are going to have on future means that any future investment plans are also being put on hold. There's been a significant slowdown in future investment planning, as well as even capacity planning on the current capital that's been deployed.
The National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa says industries relying heavily on electricity are contemplating cutting costs by laying off employees, and the working class and the poor will be hardest hit by the power cuts. Electricity will continue to be intermittent until the Medupi and Kazili power stations start producing. Medupi is expected to be online in January, but full power production from both plants could take up to 18 months. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Brian Marcoulier, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
More than a year after the largest Ebola epidemic ever recorded began in a remote part of Guinea, and 5 months after it was recognized as a public health emergency of international concern, there is still much to be done to stop the outbreak, a top American health official said after returning from the three most affected nations. Dr. Thomas Frieden, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, returned to the U.S. from West Africa on December 21st, where he spoke with patients and doctors, met with many of the CDC's 170 staff members in the region, and met with the presidents, health ministers, and Ebola coordinators in each country. He described the situation as both inspiring and sobering. It is inspiring to see how much better the response has become in the past 2 months, how much international commitment there is, and, most importantly, how hard people from each of the three countries are working to stop Ebola, Dr. Frieden said. But it is sobering that Ebola continues to spread rapidly in Sierra Leone, and that in parts of Monrovia and Conakry, Ebola is spreading unabated. Improvements in contact tracing are urgently needed. At a briefing held to discuss the results of his trip to Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, Dr. Frieden described progress in some areas, but continued growth in Ebola cases in others. In Liberia, the outbreak has slowed dramatically, and at the moment, the country has the upper hand against the virus, in part due to improvements in access to Ebola treatment units and community care centers, safe burials, and community engagement, he said. But the outbreak continues to surge in Sierra Leone, and there has been a troubling spread in Guinea's capital city. We've got a long way to go, and this is no time to relax our grip on the response. The recent approval of $1.2 billion to strengthen international response and preparedness is crucial to stopping Ebola and improving global capacity to prevent, detect, and quickly respond to health threats like Ebola in the future. As the United States and its partners continue to mobilize against the disease, we are also considering how to ensure that our immediate response measures contribute to long-term capacity to protect against infectious disease threats.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama addressing the Ebola crisis.
Ebola is actually a difficult disease to catch. It's not transmitted through the air like the flu. You cannot get it from just riding on a plane or a bus. The only way that a person can contract the disease is by coming into direct contact with the bodily fluids of somebody who is already showing symptoms. We know how to fight this disease. We know the protocols. And we know that when they're followed, they work. And if we take the steps that are necessary, if we're guided by the science, the facts, not fear, then I'm absolutely confident that we can prevent a serious outbreak here in the United States, and we can continue to lead the world in this urgent effort.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.